Hi, good morning and welcome. This is Seek Sustainable Japan. I'm JJ Walsh, your host in Hiroshima, joined by the amazing Jay Allen of Unseen Japan in Tokyo. Thanks for joining, Jay.
Thank you for having me, JJ. It's great to be here.
Now, I was talking to you before. I was surprised that you actually only started Unseen Japan in 2018. You haven't been in Japan that long. You're fresh. You've got this fresh perspective because Unseen Japan, you're diving into some very deep, real niche Japan issues and offering tours which are much deeper than the typical. How did you get so interested in Japan? Where did this come from?
Wow, big question. I've been interested in Japan. So I was an anime fan before anime was cool. I just need to put that out there. Literally, I got hooked on it, you know, starting in middle school, which, you know, I'm old. So we're talking the 1980s. I initially saw a show called Robotech, which I realized was the Japanese show Macross. And that like kicked me off on a whole thing. Back in those days, we didn't have Crunchyroll. We didn't have all the things you kids today have. So we were all trading like VHS tapes with one another through the back of the comics buyer's guide kind of thing. But that got me started into, you know, small kid growing up in a small town in upstate New York, realizing there's this like whole different world and a completely different culture and language that I just had no exposure to. And over the years, I started to get like actually like take that seriously. I finally cracked down in like 2014, started learning the language seriously. Was married to a Japanese woman for a while, for about 5 years, and lived in the States together. But as I grew older, my goal increasingly became I really want to live in Japan and experience Japan directly for myself. And that kind of led to that lifelong fascination, to led to learning the language, which led to starting Unseen Japan.
That's awesome. Well, I've been a fan of you guys for a long time. You said you're not able to do it full time quite yet. That's the dream.
That's always the dream, right? Yeah. making turning your hobby into your full time work.
Absolutely. But you come from a background, software engineer, technical writer, and then journalist, kind of led you into deeper dive into the social equity, the social impact kind of articles that we don't get enough coverage of in Japan, right? Where did that passion come to start being more of a journalist?
So originally I had somebody I had been like seeing at the time when I started like seriously learning Japanese was like, but why are you learning the language? Like, what are you going to do with it? And I was like, watch anime and read Japanese novels. I mean, that sounds like a perfectly great excuse to like learn Japanese to me. But that question kind of stuck with me. And eventually, well, like one day I was reading a book by a Japanese feminist, and she had made this offhand reference to this woman named Fukuda Kazuko. And so I tried to search for information about this woman, and I didn't find anything in English. And it turns out it was this fascinating story about this woman, Fukuda, who had been a hostess at a hostess club, had murdered one of her fellow hostesses and went on the run. And this was at a time when Japan had a 15-year statute of limitations on murder, which is something that Japanese mystery writers like love to talk about. There's like at least two Higashi no Keigo novels that center on that theme. And she almost made it. She got arrested, I think, 2 to 3 days before the statute of limitations ran out. But I thought that was like, I was fascinated at the time. I was like, how do you hide in Japan? There's not a lot of Japan to hide in. But she got plastic surgery and she did it. That was like a fascinating story. So I just wrote it up in English, put it on Medium, completely forgot about it. And I checked in like 3 months later and the story had like a couple thousand views and 10,000 views. And I was like, oh, there's like kind of like a market for people to hear stories about Japan that aren't necessarily getting into the English language. And that kicked me off on the concept that eventually became Unseen Japan.
That's an awesome origin story. I love that.
Thank you.
And I really appreciate how Unseen Japan, you're focused a lot on gender issues, talking about Japan's youngest female mayor, for example, the first to take maternity leave while she's in term. Now, this is something Jacinda Ardern also became famous for,
right,
in New Zealand while she was prime minister. And then the stalking rule, so trying to track stalkers, and is that effective or not? Prime Minister Takaichi, as well, is she actually helping Japan's gender equality or the opposite? Right. I mean, these are difficult but very important topics, as well as women feeling victimized, like in Black Box Diaries, when they talk to police about sexual abuse. These are difficult but really important issues to talk about, right?
Agreed. One of the stories that I pulled when I was thinking about like what to talk about today was one we had published recently, a woman who works at a concept cafe bar, which is, you know, kind of like a maid cafe, but different, had made his post on X about how a guy was groping her on the subway, on the train, and she stabbed him with a safety pin. And we wrote that story up because that was fascinating to me from multiple angles. First of all, I had actually written years ago about this exact strategy, because older women in Japan had been telling younger women, you know, carry a safety pin with you. That's what we always did in like the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and it's highly effective. And it ties into this larger theme that in Japan, groping, chikan, is this seriously underreported crime. There was a study that was done by a private organization some years ago that estimated as many as 80% of groping incidents don't get reported simply because the victims don't believe they'll be taken seriously. And you can see like how bad it was by the fact that around that same time, and I think this is around 2023, the Japanese government sent out a memorandum to schools that told schools, hey, you guys have been counting girls as absent or tardy because they've gone to the police to report a groping crime. We want you to stop that. That's bad. That dissuades people from actually reporting the crime. So I think it's important to, number one, report on this gap that's happening, but also number two, to report on, to me, the fascinating thing is, what is Japan thinking about this? How are people in Japan, how are women in Japan reacting to it? How are men reacting to it? How is the government reacting to it? And what steps are they taking to address that? And in some cases, like obviously like not enough's being done to address some of these issues. But it's also important to point out things like the government's memorandum, and to point out, yeah, the government recognizes that there is an issue here. It's trying to take it seriously, and it's actually taking positive steps to address it.
That is so important. And this is something that when I do tours here in Hiroshima, a lot of my women guests coming from other countries, they know about the gender gap in Japan. They right. ask me what it's like to live in Japan as a woman. Isn't it wonderful? You feel more safe when you're walking around at night, but they notice, oh, wow, there's a women's car on the train. Like, right. are there problems that they're not aware of as they're traveling around? And I often talk about raising my daughter and her saying, I don't think I'll ever come back and live in Japan. She didn't have like a toxic experience, but she grew up as a young girl in Japan feeling less than. And so, right. you know, it's sad to hear that because she loves Japan for so many reasons. But this is also something that a lot of visitors are thinking about. I don't know if you feel this way, but don't you feel like people who visit, they're kind of testing whether Japan would be a place they want to live in or not? You know, like they love Japan. They love traveling in Japan. But I have been asked so much recently, how much are the apartments around here to rent or buy? Like, people are very interested in coming to live in Japan, but this is the gender inequality, the gender bias is a big issue for international people, especially women, right?
I absolutely think so. It's it's interesting because there's like a 6-to-1, half a dozen to the other kind of thing going on, because I do believe that Japan is generally very safe. There's a very, some very interesting videos out on YouTube, for example, that focus on the experience of Black people living in Japan. And I remember this one guy being interviewed, and he says, yeah, who is from America. And he was like, yeah, the great thing about being a Black man in Japan is that I know I'm not going to get shot, you know? So there's like absolutely upsides to living here from like a safety perspective. But like, as you say, there's a lot of issues that I think people who are planning to move here, or who think, living in Japan, who are thinking along those lines, you know, don't realize that there's also a lot of friction, and the way that women's issues and safety is ignored or swept under the rug in order to like keep the statistics clean is definitely like one issue. I feel like another big one is that Japanese workplaces are actually not very pleasant places to work. And most everyone I know who works in a Japanese company is like, don't work for a Japanese company. It's not a good thing. But the other, there's a lot of issues with, you know, there's like what, like 24 different forms of harassment, you know, moral harassment, power harassment, sexual harassment, customer harassment, like a lot of people, I think, you know, they get this idealized image of Japan in their heads, and they don't realize that, unfortunately, sometimes the reality can be a lot harsher and involve, like I said, a lot more friction.
I think that's absolutely true. And I was teaching university students even once a week last year. I went back to a really good university, and it was co-ed. And the things that you hear, like teaching organizational behavior with them and talking about different work styles, like they're happy working from remote, like not going into the office every day. This is not something a typical Japanese business is ready to handle, right?
Like it's not in any way, shape or form. You're not only expected to be at the office, you're expected to be there till around 7 or 8 p.m.
Yeah.
You're expected to go out for drinks after.
Yeah, I experienced that. Working for yourself is a lot easier. And that's something a lot of young people are saying. If I stay in Japan, I'm going to do my own thing. I'm going to run my own business, especially women entrepreneurs, right? Have more flexibility that way.
Yeah, I definitely have seen that there has not historically been like a huge startup culture here, but I'm starting to see a lot more of that. I know I get a lot of pings from people who are trying to make Japan like more of like a digital nomad location as well. But yeah, I think you're seeing a little bit more entrepreneurship, particularly from that younger generation who's like, oh yeah, screw that. I want something a little bit better. Or people in Japan who know like, oh, like the US doesn't work this way. The UK doesn't work this way. They work a little bit differently and they want to get a taste of that. I think you also see that driving like the number of people who are doing like working holidays abroad, for example. A lot of people from Japan going to Australia or going to Canada on a working holiday. And obviously the money's a factor in that, but I also just think that experience of having a different work style and a different culture is something a lot of young people here really want to experience.
Absolutely. Let's switch gears a little bit. Now, one of the themes you often cover is history. And it looks like you have this great visit to the Edo Museum in Tokyo.
Oh, the Kiyoshimi Shirakawa. Yeah. I have been wanting to write that article for years. So I learned about Kiyoshimi Shirakawa like in 2016. My ex-wife took me there. It was one of the first places we ever came to in Tokyo. And she particularly wanted to introduce me to it because Kiyoshimi Shirakawa is kind of like the home of the third wave coffee movement in Japan. But researching the history, I realized there was like so much more to the area. Like I didn't know, for example, that Kiyoshimi Shirakawa is the birthplace of sumo. I didn't know it's the birthplace of the modern female geisha. There's like so much history contained in this little area of like 14,000 people, that and it's not heavily trafficked. I went there on a Saturday. A lot of like Japanese visitors, not a few foreign tourists, but like there's maybe a handful of us. And there's like so much neat stuff to see and so much interesting history in that area to talk about. I actually ended up writing two articles on this place because I did another on Kikuyu, the first female geisha, just to like kind of round out that area of the history. But yeah, I find that a fascinating little area of the city.
It is really interesting. And your since you mentioned it, Kikuyu and the first geisha, tell us about that. That was a fascinating story and not something most visitors know.
That was fascinating, particularly for me, because I've been doing more nightlife tourism recently, and that's something that I'm trying to branch out more into because I find that whole element, the nightlife entertainment culture, fascinating here as well. And Kikuyu's story was great. So originally, at that time that Kikuyu was active, so we're talking like, you know, middle of the 18th century, her dates are a little unspecific, but we know that by like the 1730, 1750, she had gone to that area that was back then known as Fukugawa. And it was a huge, you know, timber industry location. So it was thriving, a lot of new money. She had originally worked in the area that's now known as Ningyocho. And that area is particularly known for geisha, but for male geisha, who are the prominent ones at that time. And she was basically driven out of that area because she was a dancer, a nodoriko, who got a little too good at her job. And the male geishas got a little bit bitchy about that. And so they drove her out. And so she went to Fukugawa. And at the time, there was no approved or licensed female prostitution outside of this one section of the city, Yoshiwara, which was kind of like a gated in conclave. And they had the monopoly on female prostitution, but it still happened around the city with Yoshiwara instigating raids on the other locations. And one of those was Fukugawa. But Kikuyu came to Fukugawa and was like, okay, we're going to do female entertainment a little differently. We'll be selling our art, not our bodies, was the expression that she used. And that ended up resulting in the birth of what we now know as the female geisha. But it was a little different because it was very much, first of all, suited to the Fukugawa style of doing things. So the women took on male names because geishas had previously been male. They used male speech patterns because that was what the style in kind of Fukugawa at that time. And they also dressed very plainly. They dressed in gray haori overcoats instead of dressing in a stylish kimono. A part of that was, yes, you know, Kikuyu had this kind of high-minded ideal of art over sale of the physical female body. But the fact is that that still happened. But this way of pitching it from an artistic standpoint and also having the performers be more male presenting was also a good way to avoid the watchful gaze of Yoshiwara and to avoid those accusations of prostitution. And that allowed basically the female geisha to take off in Fukugawa in around the 1750s, and that began to slowly percolate to other areas of the country, like, you know, Kyoto, where it developed its own style, but I think the style that most people now more associate with the female geisha. So it's just a fascinating bit of history and showing how the history is a lot more complicated. And what we think of as, like, you know, the ancient art of the geisha is like, started about 1750. That's pretty old, but it also started in a completely different, a slightly different form than the one that we know it exists in today.
That is so interesting because, you know, like how they were dressing up kind of masculine and wearing gray and, you know, all the imagery and not knowing that geisha were originally male. I wonder if that connects at all, like to the kabuki theater and how
it does, yes,
all men troops and they would pretend to be women. So isn't that interesting? It was like the actors in kabuki are very feminine, but the women pretending to be men who are geisha are pretending to be more masculine. That's so funny. What a counter.
Well, the male geisha were specifically active in the areas around the kabuki theaters. It was very much associated with that culture. You know, so you know, men who went to see the male actors playing female roles in kabuki. You know, some of them also saw men who were basically female presenting in performing like slightly related services on the side as well. So there was a whole culture around that.
That is so fascinating. And then all the culture that changed, and like Kyoto is known for the beautiful costumery, very colorful, mm-hmm. For the maiko and the geisha, and then all the dancing and entertainment that goes along with that. But such an interesting change in history. It's like when you talk to guests about tea ceremony and how mm-hmm. tea ceremony used to be by men for men to right. help focus their mind. And now everybody has tea ceremony with beautiful women in kimono, right? Like it's changed right. a lot.
yeah, absolutely. The thing that fascinates me is I like to trace back like where do all these things that we outside of Japan think of as ancient Japanese tradition, like how far back do they actually extend? How deep is their history? Surprising amount of what we view as, you know, Japanese culture, traditional Japanese culture dates back to Edo. It goes to the Edo area and maybe has like some predecessors before that. But Edo was an incredibly culturally significant era because it was the first time that Japan was actually in some ways a united Japan. You know, the country was, even during the Edo era, it was still a loose collection of feudal territories that was basically kept together by force. But it was that the first time that there was a lasting and sustained peace for over 200 years. And that led to this huge cultural flourishing that we see today. But this connects back to some of the social issues we were talking about, which is that a lot of things that are now being defended socially as Japanese culture or tradition haven't been around for even 200 years. So there's a whole debate, for example, around separate spousal surnames. Where the fact that if you're a Japanese woman and you're marrying a Japanese man, you two have to agree on the same last name. You can't have separate last names. And that is something that Japan passed in the Meiji era, I think like 1890s or 1897, something around there, that they had originally modeled after European law. So it wasn't even a Japanese tradition at that point. But the European nations all repealed those laws like decades ago. Japan still has its on the books, but now there's a lot of people who say, oh no, this is the Japanese way of doing things. It's like, yeah, for like 120 years out of the 2000 year plus history of the Japanese people, you know, it's not that ancient of a tradition.
That's right. That's why studying history in Japan is so relevant when you're doing tours, because it relates so much to modern society in Japan, right? Another mm-hmm. example is how they're having the big debate about succession and mm-hmm. will the right. daughter of the imperial couple be allowed to take the role? And in Japanese history, there were many empresses over Japanese mm-hmm. history, right? So why good this one. Big debate, whether it's okay or not, is also very interesting and quite recent, right?
It is, yeah. That's an interesting debate because I have dug into that a little bit. And there's arguments on both. It's less that there's arguments on both sides and more that there's layers to it. So you know, have there been female empresses in the past? There have. Absolutely, like 8, I believe. But there's also the other side is arguing, well, yes, there have been female empresses, but there hasn't been matrilineal, there hasn't been matrilineage. You know? So the title of empress basically like hasn't passed down through the female line. It's traditionally passed down through the male line. So a lot of the surveys that come out that say, oh yeah, like 80% of Japanese people would love to see Aiko Princess Toshi become the empress is true. But then if you dig in, a lot of the papers aren't asking, well, should the law change to allow for matrilineage, which is a completely, you know, separate issue. And I don't know that we actually have a good read on what the Japanese public would think about that. But the fact remains that they have to do something, because there's like two people who can be emperor now. And if they don't change that, there's going to be problems in the next several decades.
Now, all of these issues relate to some of the articles and tours that you offer, like, for example, Kabukicho, taking people into the nightlife area. And I think there's so much relevance for this, because you want to guide people to do it safely, to do it with good etiquette, with locals who know where to go, where they're going to be welcome. Talk about this kind of nightlife tour options that you have.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely important, because an area like Kabukicho, you get there and you're immediately going to, if you're there like in the evening, like anywhere from 8 p.m. onward when it's starting to get dark, you're immediately going to be approached, particularly if you're like a single guy or a group of guys, or, well, let's start there because there's two different facets to it. But if you're like a single guy or a group of guys, you're going to be approached at some point by barkers. And the barkers are going to be like, oh, hey, like, come into the store. This is a great store. You know, we got girls, you know, they'll show you stuff. And what a lot of people don't know is that practice, kyakuhiki in Japanese, pulling customers into the business, is strictly illegal. They're not supposed to be doing that. By Japanese law, you can do mutokte yobidashi. You can be standing out there and just like with the women for the con cafes and the girls bars are doing with a sign that says, you know, 2,000 yen for an hour, all you can drink, no mihodai, so long as you're not calling to a specific individual. Calling to a specific individual is illegal. People do it anyway, because these barker systems are run by generally organized crime groups, and they will get people into a given izakaya or a girls bar that is a shady business and try to rack up, you know, thousands to several thousands of dollars and charges on your card before you walk out in the evening. You know, so people absolutely have to be careful when they're walking around in these neighborhoods, and not just go into a place, for example, because somebody's urging you to walk into the place. That's usually a setup for something bad about to happen.
Absolutely. And then there's other little things, which like, for example, the seating charge. Like, you're likely in the drinking area to walk into a bar and immediately be given some kind of little snack. And that's part of the seating charge that you're going to be charged. Going with a local guide, you're going to be able to inform them, if we go in here, this is the system, and teach them kind of the etiquette of the drinking culture in Japan a bit, which helps both sides, right?
Right, yeah. And if you're going to a legitimate business, like if you're going into like an izakaya, that's going to be maybe like a 400, 500 yen charge. There's some bars where the seating charge will be more substantial, like 1,000 to 3,000 yen per person, like smaller bars with an intimate atmosphere. I've been to a few that do that as well. But yeah, there's going to be some unscrupulous ones that are going to, you know, try to, you know, slip in an even larger charge into that. And for a group, that can rack up to like over 10,000 yen, you know, pretty quickly, very easily. Yeah, so understanding that that's the custom, and that you really need to be looking for a place with like a decent reputation is really important.
Absolutely. Now, speaking of charges, recently in the news, there's a new charge for littering in Shibuya. Now, most visitors who come to Japan, they want to go to Shibuya Crossing. That's something everybody kind of gravitates to. But now, if you're caught leaving litter on the ground, it's 2,000 yen fine. But also, it was interesting in the Japan Times article talking about how vendors who are selling things which immediately become trash, if they don't have a garbage can, they can be fined 50,000 yen. So I thought that was a really positive. It's not just about the people who are like, there's no garbage can, but it's also the vendors have responsibility. What do you think about this new rule? I heard you're writing about it.
Yeah, we are. We should have an article coming out. I think tomorrow is when we're aiming for it. You know, this is something that we've tracked a lot because there's this perennial debate over should Japan have more public garbage cans. It used to until the Shinrikyo attack, the sarin gas attack. And after that, they began reducing the number of them. And then a lot of municipalities realized, hey, we can use that as an excuse to cut our garbage collection costs even further. But the problem now is that in areas like Shibuya, garbage collects on the streets because there's nowhere to put it. And so the city is relying on private volunteers to keep things clean, which I don't think is an ideal circumstance. But it's devolved into this whole, it's now become a moral debate because now people are like, taking your trash with you out of a place is traditional Japanese culture and you need to respect the culture. Again, never mind that this is maybe like a change in the past 20 or 30 years. But instead of trying to look at it from just like a practical standpoint, it becomes a moral debate. So people are like, you know, should you or shouldn't you be a good tourist and take your garbage out with you versus what is the best way for incredibly highly touristed areas like Shibuya to keep their streets clean and to keep, you know, everything in a good working order for everybody. So I feel like when these, I think that the 2,000 yen fine is probably a good idea in the long run. You know, people shouldn't be littering, and if you're caught at it, you should be fined for it so that, you know, the city has the funds to help, you know, offset this flood of tourists who are coming to take pictures in the scramble and keep everything clean. But at the same time, I think there's probably going to be more debate needed in the long run about, you know, public disposal facilities and, you know, providing more garbage cans to reduce the amount of litter. I wrote about this a few months ago, even longer, like a little over a year ago. And a lot of other cities in locations like, you know, Australia and in New York City have found that putting out more public garbage cans, you know, as you would expect, actually does reduce the amount of trash that gets thrown onto the ground and the amount of cleanup that has to be done afterwards. So from a practical standpoint, putting out a bunch more garbage cans actually does work. But now we're caught up in this whole moral debate that makes it harder to actually have a rational policy debate.
Yeah. It's an interesting discussion, isn't it? Because this is something new visitors always talk about on tours. And part of our tour route, we always stop by places you can have a trash can and get rid of your trash. And I've heard it's a labor crunch related reason that they analyzed which trash cans were overflowing. And they thought if there's no trash can, people are less likely to leave it on the street. If there's an overflowing trash can, they're going to add more, and they obviously can't empty it fast enough, so they're going to take it away. So it's really interesting, right? The different reasons in different areas. But to have designated areas, especially in places people are buying street food and immediately you have this trash, it really makes a lot of sense. And then to add that extra layer of more labor to empty it faster would certainly help. I was shocked going around Tokyo and like Kamakura area, no trash cans anywhere. Like even in the convenience stores, they stopped them there. So it is like That's extreme, right? It's a little extreme.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point about like overflowing trash cans, because I see that even in my neighborhood, like even in areas where you don't have trash cans, near Jihanki, the vending machines, there a lot of times there will be a can and bottle disposal as well, which number one, people use that to throw out non-can and non-bottle trash. But even those cans, like when they're overflowing, people are still trying to like stuff more into them. It's kind of a sight to behold. And as somebody who lives in Tokyo, I quickly learned, whenever I go to Konbini, if they ask me if I want a bag with it, my answer is yes, because I need a bag to carry my trash around, because whatever I buy here, I'm probably going to be carrying with me until I either stop in at the next Konbini or until I get home and can throw it away. You know, so I've gotten habituated to that. And I think all of us who live here have gotten habituated to that. You know, the question becomes, is that something we can reasonably expect from tourists as a way to help keep the streets clean? Unfortunately, the data seems to be leaning towards no, and that there has to be some other solutions. I'm interested to see if the fine helps, how much it's going to be enforced, and how much it's actually cracked down on. Tying that back, if I can, to like jump around a little bit, but tying that back to the Hiyakuhiki thing I was talking about earlier, where barking is, you know, is technically illegal and it will be cracked down on. And in Kabukicho, you've seen there's definitely a lot more enforcement on the main drag. So if you're like going by the infamous Toyoko area right in front of the Tokyo Gramercy Hotel, you know, there's a lot more police presence, and there's a lot of like, you know, quasi public people doing patrols against the Kyakuhiki to prevent that practice. But then you immediately go off into the side streets where all the action is in Kabukicho, and you'll immediately be approached by, you know, people from, you know, like Nigeria or elsewhere who are working for these, you know, shady criminal organizations who are like, you know, hey man, come into the store. You know, so that still happens despite it being illegal. And despite it, if they get caught, like that's not even just a fine, that's a fine plus potential jail time that those people are facing, you know, but they're still doing it. So I'm a little skeptical that just like having a 2,000 yen, which is like what, like a $13-14 fine, is going to deter a lot of people from littering. But we'll see what the impact actually is.
Yeah, you mentioned on Blue Sky the other day, you also saw an interesting sign about don't pee on this bridge or something near your, but it was only in Japanese. So we're seeing both sides, right, of etiquette that...
So that is something I'm actually working on an entire essay about, because there's like an entire history behind those.
It's interesting, isn't it? Some signs are in English, why others are only in Japanese. It makes you think, there's a local issue or a visitor issue, right?
Yeah, and in terms of like the public urination, one thing that I found is that that is very much like a Showa era issue. So back in the Showa period, so like up until like the 1980s, it used to be considered an ordinary practice for, you know, men to just go and like pee in public. It wasn't legal. You weren't supposed to be doing that, but a lot of people simply ignored the legal regulations and did it anyway, which is why in my neighborhood, like there's signs up in just the Japanese saying, please don't pee under this bridge. You see that all around. You see it in Megurobashi. You see it like pretty much everywhere you go. And it's kind of like a relic of that era. And so it gets into this whole, like you said, it gets into this whole question of like how much of this is, you know, tourists behaving badly versus how much of this is, you know, the locals behaving badly, which is there's still a fair share of that. I think there's a stereotype that Japanese people will always follow the rules. And I'm like, a lot of people in Japan, yes, they do follow the rules. And some people will not follow the rules, though, if they don't think they'll be caught not following them.
That is that, you know, like talking about how my kids grew up here and learning good manners and etiquette in Japanese school, it's definitely part of the socialization. But yeah, it's not 100% if they get away with it, or, you know, like tourists as well, not understanding. Now, one of the things kind of connected to less talked about issues, when I take people around Hiroshima Peace Park, even, this is something I point out. There's a love hotel right next to Peace Park. And I know that you've talked about love hotels on Unseen Japan, how to do it with good etiquette, like how to follow the rules. Mm-hmm. Now, there's more than 37,000 love hotels in Japan, but they have been struggling in recent years. And so you're seeing more conversion of love hotels into like tourist hotels. So it is a really interesting thing connected to tourism. Can you talk about why you started like featuring the love hotel issue?
I think it's definitely like a centerpiece of Japanese nightlife. It's something that's, you know, very uniquely Japan in a lot of ways. You know, these businesses started to sprout up, you know, partially because, you know, there's just like not a lot of space in Japan and not a lot of really strong walls, you know, so it's a good place for couples to go. But they're also part of this, there's a dual thing that they're part of. It is that it's just kind of part of cheating culture here, which, you know, tends to be, there's a fairly strong cheating culture here, I would say. And on top of that, there's also a large underground sex culture. So there's a lot of enjokosai, you know, paid dating. There's papakatsu, sugar babying. And I think that's increasing a lot more with the advent of the internet, as a lot of sex workers, instead of, you know, some of them work for like these large groups like Natural and the others that are running, you know, both domestic and overseas, you know, sex worker groups in Japan. But you're also seeing a lot of people kind of go out on their own because the internet enables them to do that. And love hotels are part of that kind of overall, both above ground and underground nightlife culture as well. And you'll also find, you know, within like areas like Kabukicho, you'll find the you'll find the Muryo Annaijo, the free information centers, they're euphemistically called, where like you can go and they will arrange a very complicated hookup situation with you, where you meet a woman at either a love hotel or a smaller rental room. Yeah, so there's like this whole economy associated with them too that I just like sort of find fascinating. At the same time, there's a lot of like conservatism that goes along with these that's like uniquely Japanese, which is, you know, something I found out when digging into it. Like, for example, not a lot of love hotels are LGBTQ friendly. A lot will specifically forbid more than one man from entering the room at a time, which I don't think is necessarily rooted in like anti-gay prejudice. I think it was more, it was more like anti-crime, and based on the theory that two or more men in a love hotel room are probably like, you know, organized crime related, or will potentially like, you know, be more violent than, for example, like a group of women who are using a love hotel room. So there's like a lot of little surprises that you run into that you don't necessarily expect, because you would think, oh, love hotel, it's got the word love in it. It's probably like a kind of like anything goes atmosphere, and that's not true at all.
Yeah, the way I talk about it, and I think this is part of it too, is how Japan often had multi-generational families. It's not that polite to do it at home if you got grandma and grandpa upstairs, right?
True.
So yeah, having that option, I also, over the years, I have used love hotels on my own. Just doing a long trip and needing a quick shower and a relax before I like meet someone, you know, it is used for different reasons as well.
For joshikais and things. Yeah,
right? Absolutely. And one of my Japanese friends said she does that. And if she checks in by herself, she'll mention, I'm just here to have a little refresh. And the ladies often bring her a cup of tea, you know.
That's beautiful. Yeah, there are a lot of hotels that will, they have like special, you know, Jose Gente rates or special rates for women. And, you know, women will go and they'll do Joshikai girl meetups and just like spend a few hours or a night in a love hotel. They're actually just like really fun places to kind of hang out. One of my favorite, and I encourage people to check it out, and this kind of ties into what you're saying with the current crossover you're seeing between like love hotels and like actual like, you know, staycation hotels, is the Balian hotels inside in Shinjuku's Kabukicho are incredibly fun. The main Balian one has rooms that will fit like up to 8 or 10 people with like these crazy like bunk bed setups. But the Balian itself, there's a really nice like little snack bar downstairs and drink bar. They've got a billiards room. They've got a karaoke room. They've got a darts table. They've got like a massage parlor. Like, it's just a fun place to go to hang out. They have another building that's specifically for glamping. You go there and you don't just sleep, you camp inside for the night. You know, so yeah, they're just like fun places to hang out. You can find love hotels that have water slides inside of them. So you can go and, you know, not go to do anything naughty. You can just go to like slide on the water slide and watch movies on the huge TV and drink with your friends and have fun for the night. They're very cool places.
That's awesome. I love the article. You were talking about some of the theme ones, but maybe not the best sometimes.
Like, oh, Sweet Hotel, RIP. They're out of business now.
Oh, they're out of business. You talked about the chocolate fountain bath or something.
Yeah, that didn't work.
But this one is gorgeous, also on your website, with a beautiful like jacuzzi bath right next to the bed. I mean, some of them, they're just so fun. And I could totally imagine, I saw on your tours, you're actually including like a love hotel party as one of the options for tours. I love that.
Yeah, we haven't, no one's taken us up on that yet, but that would be like a really fun thing to arrange for sure. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think it goes back to that idea, like it is a local business. You're teaching mm-hmm. people how to do it with good etiquette, the way locals do, the right way, right? And to have fun. And I think that connects so well with the nightlife experience, a lot of the tours you're offering. And it looks like you're getting good feedback about your nightlife tours as well, right?
Yeah, we are. We try to, like you said earlier, we try to do something that's, I think, a little different than other companies do with all of our tours, not just the nightlife ones either. You know, we offer fully customized experiences. So instead of like offering like a tour packet, like a simple set tour, like the kind of thing you can buy off of Klook for a few hours, for example, as well. Instead of doing something like that, we have people come to us and we ask them, like, what do you want or what are you looking for? What kind of experiences do you want? Sometimes they know, sometimes they don't. And they're more like, you know, surprise me, show me the Japan that you'd like me to see. Show me the things that like you talk about in your articles and want to go into like a bit more detail on. So that allows us to take people and show them, you know, not just what currently exists, like, and the variety of what currently exists, but also to talk about the history behind it, how it evolved, and some of the issues that are currently, you know, making the news. So for example, when we go through Kabukicho these days, there's a famous area with the big presence of host club signs where you see like Club Dandy and a bunch of the other host clubs advertise themselves. And I like to point out that just a year ago, those signs had text on them that would say, oh, this guy is the number one player at the host club. And to back off for listeners who might not know, a host club is where mainly female customers go in order to be entertained by a male host, usually very good looking, slightly androgynous men in their 20s and 30s.
And according to one of your articles, a reason a lot of women get into debt and then
is these host clubs, absolutely.
Into prostitution as well, right?
Right. Because you can rack up thousands of dollars a month buying expensive champagne and other services at these clubs. But those signs used to say, like, you know, this guy's the number one player, this guy's the number two player. Basically, like, this is how much money they've made off of their clients, which I always found was a unique way of advertising the business, but it worked and they did it. But that text is now gone from those signs because it was specifically made illegal in this last revision to the Fuzoku, the entertainment law, specifically as an attempt to crack down on host clubs. So they outlawed that. They outlawed the Naishobai. So basically like hosts telling their customers, I love you, I want to be with you forever, in order for them to give them more money. A whole raft of those kind of related practices was just banned under the new ordinance. So you go to Kabukicho and see those signs now, and all that text has been wiped off of that. And we like to talk to people about, you know, that kind of thing is still happening, is that Japan has basically been like trying to crack down on its nightlife, and these are like repeated boom bust cycles for hundreds of years. Here's what's happening now, and here's the way that the the area and the businesses are basically like working around it and doing some variation of it anyway.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like my son has been studying in the Netherlands. When you visit Amsterdam and you see how prostitution has been legalized and it actually protects the women, they have health care. There's no violence against women. There's no underage prostitution. And you think, is this a better system for Japan? Because it's always been battling the dark side and the unknown and the secret and the hidden, right?
Right. And they're talking about prostitution now because, you know, like you mentioned, a lot more women are getting into sex work, and particularly that area in Okubo at Okubo Park, right past Kabukicho, has become even more of a hotbed for prostitution. It has always been so, but it was mainly like non-Japanese women who were playing the trade there. And in recent years, because of issues like mounting host club debt, you know, the financial impact of COVID-19, there are a lot more Japanese women are, you know, standing out doing street prostitution on the corner, which is, you know, illegal under Japanese law. But there was a huge backlash trying to crack down on it. There was this incident that happened last year where four women were arrested in Okubo Park and their names were publicized, and everyone was outraged because they're like, why are you publicizing the names of the women and not the men who were seeking their services? So now there's this debate, not around legalization, but around the Nordic model. So they're seriously discussing, oh, well, let's like start arresting the Johns. Let's start arresting the customers and try to kill it off the source. There are some sex worker advocates who are advocating for decriminalization, but unfortunately, I have not seen that is a majority voice or anything that the Takaichi government is currently seriously considering.
It's an interesting issue, and I appreciate you guys focusing on it because this is one of the social issues that often does not end up in the news. Mm-hmm. It's really important for visitors, but also residents to know about these things and to keep up mm-hmm. with the issues that impact so many people.
I think our statistics in our business model kind of point out that there's a lot of hunger for this kind of content for people covering, you know, these issues. Like, we make a fair amount of our money from the editorial side of the business off of covering these issues because people like really want to hear about it. A lot of the mainstream English press, like, they've been talking a little bit more about the host clubs in particular. But in general, like, to find out more about, you know, like the increase in like international prostitution, you know, these like large crime groups like Natural that are running, you know, basically like underground prostitution rings domestically as well. That's covered in Japan by like the Japanese tabloid press, like publications like Friday and Weekly Spa. But you don't see even a lot of the mainstream press outside of maybe like Asahi and Mainichi covering it. And you definitely don't see a lot of it getting into the English language news as well. So since it's an area of interest for us too, it's something that, you know, we've been enthusiastic about keeping track on and making sure that people stay informed about.
Absolutely. Switching gears a little bit about mm-hmm. Shimokitazawa. So talking about lesser known gems around Tokyo to visit as well. It's a lovely area. Lots of recycle shops, secondhand vintage shops are there. Tell us a little bit about it. Why should people visit?
You're bringing up a controversial article. It's more of like a kind of like a counterculture area of the city. It's a big there's a big music scene there. A big part of the Japanese underground music scene is there. There's like a hugely popular jazz club there that's been active since the 1970s. And like you said, a lot of antique and consignment shops as well, and a lot of great places to like eat and visit. I think one of the places that I point out in the article is there's a new development off to the side of Shimokitazawa as well that has like a lot of little bookstores. They have like a weekend fair that occurs over there. One of my favorite little coffee places is over there. It's actually Fukuzue, which I talk about in the article. It's a book cafe. So you go in and you can pay for like a certain fee to just like stay there literally for hours and read your books and have coffee and have treats. And it's a nice little relaxed atmosphere. And there's a lot of like community gatherings that happen over there too. So like a lot of like talks and political talks happen over the weekends. And it's a source of a lot of political activism locally. We've had some people whenever we republish that article, they're like, oh, Shimokita is how it used to be cool, but now it's being taken over by the big corpos and it's sold out, and you know, basically like Seattle hipster kind of feedback about Shimokita Zawa. But I think yeah, like any you're gonna hear that like about any place that's like, you know, offbeat, or that people were like, oh yeah, that used to be cool, but now everyone thinks it's cool, so it's not cool anymore. I still think it's cool, and I still think that it doesn't get the appreciation from foreign tourists that it could.
Yeah. I love that area. I had friends who actually rented in that area, and so we got to hang out there. It was so fun.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Nice. That would be a lot of fun.
I think they got really lucky. But yeah, just, you know, and the whole idea of secondhand, vintage, reuse, recycle what we already have, you know, that's a very sustainable travel, sustainable life focus, which I love
absolutely.
As well. Do you want to introduce the other people on your team for Unseen Japan as well as for the tours?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So Noah and I have actually been working on Unseen Japan since shortly after it started. I think like about 6 months after I started it, he and I met online and he began writing for the site. And Noah basically leads the tours part of the business. Yeah, you know, I work with him on it, particularly like on like the management and marketing side. But he's the genius behind a lot of the actual tour planning, and he's our main tour guide as well. Christina is another one of our tour guides. She's a native of Michigan, a Japanese American native who lives here now and works in the tours business, currently working in the high-end luxury tours area of the industry as well. But she's also a professional kimono stylist, and she's also a professional a certified Miko, a Japanese shrine maiden. So she can cover like a lot of areas of traditional Japanese culture that I think a lot of tourists who come to the country are really interested in. And Noah, in terms of just like, we're talking about a man with like encyclopedic knowledge of Japanese history. If you've never read Noah's stuff on our site or watched, he runs our YouTube channel as well. So, you know, if you're not a big reader, please go to the YouTube. He just did a two-part essay on the history of Shinjuku, and he just published the YouTube version of that. So from the Naito passageway in the 1700s and 1800s on up to the Kubikicho that we know today. So if you're interested in Japanese history and wanted to know more about nightlife history in particular, you know, please check that out. It's amazing.
That's awesome. And finally, how can people find your work, watch your videos? You mentioned the YouTube channel. Where else are you guys on?
So go to unseen-japan.com. You can find everything there. We're on all the major social media networks. We tend to interact the most with people on Blue Sky. We also have a Discord channel, so you can join our Discord and you can join us there and chat with us one-on-one there as well. But yeah, start from the website. Go there, sign up for our newsletter as well. Join our Blue Sky, join our Discord. We'd be happy to chat with you.
That's awesome. Thanks so much, Jay, for joining. What a great conversation.
Thank you, JJ. I've had a lot of fun, and thank you for having me on again.
That's good. A pleasure. Always nice to talk with people doing great articles, but you're also doing wonderful tours. So you're working both for people living in Japan, but also visitors. I love all that you're doing. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much. And you too.
Thanks. Thanks, everyone, for joining. See you again next time. Take care.